Nomine Patris, Filii, Spiritus Sancti. Amen. Ave Maria, gratia plena, Dominus tecum, benedicta tu in mulieribus, et benedictus fructus ventris tui, Iesus.
Sancta Maria, Mater Dei, ora pro nobis peccatoribus, nunc et in hora mortis nostrae. Amen.
Nomine Patris, et Filii, Spiritus Sancti. Amen. Brethren in Christ, Christ is risen. Christus erexit, Christos anesti. Happy Easter, everybody. Welcome to another edition of Christ Against the Occult with Michael Joseph. Michael, how you doing, brother?
Hey, Tim, how are you? I'm doing
excellent.
Fine.
Excellent, excellent. Christ is King. We come to the epic century of occultism. Enter Freemasonry. So today we're going to go into the 1700s. We've gone through five parts of the war of the occult against the church. And it really seems that, Michael, it seems that Freemasonry really brings together kind of all these occult forces in sort of a focused manner. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, it just kind of synthesizes everything here, I would say. And, you know, goes into a wide variety of viewpoints based upon the same principles, kind of like a lot of left-right dialectics that split off into their own left and right dialectics and so on, just causing a lot of chaos.
It seems like Masonry has been the most successful occult movement in the history of the church, because before this, I mean, we pretty much live in Masonic captivity now at this point. Masonic revolutions have been perpetrated across the world at this point, and we are living in a Masonic universe. So, go ahead.
I always call it Satan's Big Bang moment, I think, these revolutions, particularly the French one.
Yes. So, Freemasonry, we've gone through, so quick recap, last episode, we got up to about 1700, and we were talking about John Dee and the British Empire and the occultism of that, got into a little Luther. Where do you want to start here, Michael?
Well, basically, this whole episode, I think, I'm going to focus on using the memoirs of Jacobinism, because I've read through the whole thing, and I think it's unknown information that really should be known, because it helps really destroy, I think, the Enlightenment. So I think using that, I can go into everything that's relevant here. First of all, when you hear people talk about the French Revolution and you know, how it got into all this chaos, and usually you have the excuse as well, these people really just wanted reforms, right? They were sincere reformers. They didn't want this huge revolution, and unfortunately, it got out of hand, right? Kind of sounds familiar to the Protestant Revolution, right? So you're going to see a relationship here between Protestantism and Masonry, where one, it's easier to de-Christianize the Protestant territories, generally speaking, and two, they're more tolerant of these Masonic ideas because they've been crying for tolerance, and now the Masons are going to want tolerance, so they have this kind of like tolerance unity where the Catholic Church is intolerant, right? And then third point, the more zealous Protestants end up being used as proxy warriors, basically, in particular the Huguenots, the Calvinists, and then later I think the Lutheran spirit too as well, and we'll give examples of that from the conspirators' own writings. And this isn't just, you know, Catholics trying to make it so. This is them basically saying these people were using them in a variety of ways. And so I would also say, you know, I can't get into this part too much, but the whole anti-monarchical stuff, obviously there's criticisms against kings, but there's also some defenses. And I would recommend people who want to bash somebody like Louis XVI, read his last will and testament. And he's just been revolted against by his people. He's in prison, probably going to be executed. Read what he has to say and see if he seems like some horrible, awful person. Also, in the beginning of this book, the guy who does the introduction is the Jackie version. I'll give you a link. People can, anything I'm going through, you can check it yourself. It's free to read on archive.org. And I'll also mention the chapters and pages when applicable, so you can go check it out for yourself. But he gives accounts of people in the beginning, even revolutionaries themselves, one in particular, a Madame Roland, who was a Girondin. So she's sympathetic to the revolution, but she sees the horror of it, where there was heads on pikes in the streets, the intestines of people being ripped out, worn as turbans, women being horribly violated, despite apparently this revolution, you know, always being seen as like bring about women's rights later, stuff like that. Well, you know, look at what was going on or look at some of those accounts. And I think it's hard to find a lot of those accounts of the disgusting stuff. And I think there's a reason for that, but there are some out there. People can say they're exaggerated or not, but we'll let you decide. So with that kind of in mind, maybe I can start talking about Augustin Barrowell, who wrote the memoirs of Jacobitism and is called a crazy conspiracy theorist by many different groups. He was a Jesuit priest who fled the revolution. He was alive pretty much during this entire century. I think died in the early 1800s. And ironically, King George III welcomes him and the other people fleeing into England. So Jesuits being welcomed and given refuge in England is kind of an irony. Maybe that's, you know, God's irony in the grander scheme of things, where they were being previously hung, drawn, and quartered a few centuries ago, right?
And they were also suppressed by the Pope at this time, too, which is
yes, weird. That's a complicated thing. We can kind of touch upon it here a little bit as well. Now, where he gets his sources for all this stuff, basically Voltaire's homeboys, as I call them, they publish all of his letters. I think Condorcet is an important figure as like a biographer. Apparently they have like really no fear because they're in control. So they're going to publish Voltaire's letters. Barrowell says that some things are kind of redacted, but generally speaking, they're pretty damning, but there's thousands of letters and he's the one combing through them all. So I think he's kind of giving you what's in these letters that modern history either doesn't really want to show you, or once they find it out, they try to just, you know, give some sort of, that's not a big deal. Right. And then the Bavarian Illuminati stuff, all these documents from that order was confiscated in Bavaria by the Bavarian police. So he has access to those. So he provides you with all of that in the later parts. And then everything else is just basic stuff, you know, the history books available at the time, different newspapers. So he's sourcing a wide variety of things and looking at it holistically. That's how people tend to miss the point. He's doing all these different things where he's taking personal testimony, writings of themselves. And then there's the issue of primary evidence, secondary, tertiary, right? So when people attack, usually they take the tertiary things and they say, oh, look what he's presenting here. That's not proof. But they'll ignore all the primary stuff. So I'm trying to provide some of the maybe the more damning stuff that you can find in here in this video. And really just listen to the people themselves talk about it and you can decide. And the last thing I'd mention, there's some criticisms of Barrowell. One is that he exonerates the English too much and blames everything on the Bavarian Illuminati. And, you know, that's his blunder. The Bavarian Illuminati had nothing to do with the French Revolution. That's crazy. And why did he blame them, right? People also criticize him for things like using bad translations with an agenda and ignoring economic conditions, stuff like that. And that's not really as relevant to what we're going to go through here. So in response to that, I would say, read the conclusion of part four. It's a long book, 800 some pages. It's in the very last parts of the book. So if people miss this, I understand, but I'm going to read some of it and you can decide for yourself if he's really exonerating the English or blaming just the Illuminati.
I have a question as well. I don't know if you want to answer this later, whatever, but sure. Does Barrowell discuss the American Revolution?
Not as much. He's writing this book to send to the American revolutionaries to warn them about this stuff. But again, he's okay. Not over there. He's running for his life. I'm sure he's probably not super interested in what's going on in America, Generally speaking. And we'll talk about Thomas Jefferson in relationship to that.
Yes.
So anyways, like I said, he views the revolution holistically. Honestly, there's only a few pages. And I knew about this theory before I read it. So I was actually looking for that. And I kind of got surprised at some things. There's a couple of pages where you could make the case that he's blaming the ideas solely on the Illuminati, but really he's connecting the ideas themselves, not necessarily the individual personages. One of the adepts, Mirabeau, you can look him up in history if you'd like. I don't have time to get into every single person. He's like the most solid connection between these two groups, but nevertheless, he looks at it holistically. And next point, he admits there's the majority of like the Blue Lodge Masonry, which is the Masonry that's like, we like God and country and Christianity in kind of a generic sense. And it's the first 3 degrees. So he's saying that's predominant in London, where he was staying. And he calls this the National Masonry. However, he says on page 806, quote, "I should have been more circumspect in my exception had I known of a pamphlet entitled Freemasonry, A Word to the Wise." So he's saying maybe I shouldn't have been so quick to exonerate the Masons in England, because I found this pamphlet that showed me that this stuff is, you know, the esoteric stuff is there as well. And then later, this is where it gets interesting. On pages 827 through 828, he does a complete 180. And he says, quote, "Masons of England, what a fatal gift you have made to the world. And that if England created the baneful present to the universe," meaning the Jacobin Masons, "that hopefully England would," quote, "be the first to sacrifice its own lodges for the safety of nations." So here he's blaming England for the Jacobins and saying that if you want to make amends, you should be the first to sacrifice your lodges of masonry for the safety of everybody. Basically, get rid of masonry in England altogether. If you led the charge and did that, he's hoping that they be remembered in the history books for leading the charge against masonry, even though they created it. So that's what he says here. Now, to me, it doesn't sound like he's exonerating English masonry there. He's calling it the source of the problem, but it took him a while. And that's at the very end when he's concluding the whole thing, right? And then basically saying like their lack of remorse or repentance or prosecuting their own Masons is kind of proof that of their guilt. Right. And this is perhaps akin to the 2020 Summer of Love, where we have so-called peaceful protests running around and nobody wants to prosecute it. Maybe because all these older 1960s revolutionaries realize that they're all operating on the same principles and they can't, you know, it's their own Frankenstein child, right? They don't want to denounce it. So I think that that's kind of the point that he's making. Now, as to...
Let me jump in. I just wanted to say something about British masonry in relation to the American Revolution, because the American Revolution is essentially... Or the whole Masonic Whig elite government structure in Britain and the British colonies is sort of a conservative status quo, because it's trying to conserve an anti-Catholic order. So they've already had their anti-Catholic revolution in 1688, and they're trying to conserve, they're conservatives. They're conservative anti-Catholics. And so they're, so that's why the American Revolution is still seen today by conservatives to this day as sort of a conservative revolution, because it is. It's trying to conserve an anti-Catholic order. And that's why the Masonry is sort of this sort of quote-unquote conservative Masonry.
Because and I'll show you a split of that dialectic in France, actually.
Okay, perfect.
Montesquieu kind of represents more of that Whig masonry that's conserving that.
Right. So they're preserving an anti-Catholic disorder, really. And then in France, you do have a Catholic in name only order. It is Catholic in name. It's not very Catholic in substance, but there's still a Catholic order. So they have to go sort of all the way to the left in their revolution. It's sort of a liberal anti-Catholic revolution in France. So the Masonry is sort of the same goal of anti-Catholicism, but different means.
Yeah, France is a lot more complicated, and we'll get into the reasons why here, at least as far as I know, I can tell. So in response to saying he blames only the Bavarian Illuminati, on page 822 through 823, Barwell says, quote, "If you follow the Jacobin to his pantheon of gods," he's being poetic here, "he will be burning his incense essentially to Voltaire and Rousseau." And he gives a poetic account here of what the dead souls from the revolution might say if they were to cry out for vengeance from heaven, and who they would blame as their killers. And he says, quote, "It is not the Jacobins that we call down vengeance from heaven. For you," referring to Voltaire and Rousseau, "were our real murderers. You are now the object of the Jacobins' adoration, but you were our first executioners, and you brought the king to the scaffold, and you still continue to be the butchers of our progeny." So he's saying the murderer of the king, the real murderers, if the souls could cry out for vengeance, would be blaming Voltaire and Rousseau, not the Bavarian Illuminati. So that's erroneous if people want to make that claim. If you read that right there, I mean, that's plain as day to me. He's basically saying who these guys burn incense to as their gods are the source of the revolution. But as we get through, we might see some of the sources of Voltaire and stuff like that, right? And then I'd say read the final chapter if you want rebuttals to the translation criticism. It ironically refutes all the same things I've heard today. All back during this time, people were just making the same stuff. So you can refer to that if you'd like. So what I like to do is get into some of the more broad strokes of the first book, The Anti-Christian Conspiracy. Basically, it involves what I call the unholy trinity of Voltaire, Frederick the Great, King of Prussia, and Jean-Laurent d'Alembert. He's kind of like Voltaire's sidekick. And then there's like an honorable or maybe dishonorable fourth mention with Denis Diderot. I'm sure I'm going to butcher French names. You're just going to have to deal with it. These are the people most responsible for this anti-Christian conspiracy, getting religion to be scorned in France and basically in Europe. There's other figures like Marquis Condorcet, Duke of Choiseul. He's more integral to the Jesuits being expelled, Philippe Galate, etc. But nevertheless, those are the big three. Now, the Protestant rulers, as we mentioned, on the whole, are going to be much more influenced by this. And maybe if you want to bring the map up while I talk about this, this will be useful. If you read letters from various princes to Voltaire, it's all in there. You're going to find that so many of these Protestant royalty princes, especially, and the princesses, are all super enamored with him. Like, they're infatuated. You know, it's like the atheist with Neil deGrasse Tyson or something, right? And Voltaire and D'Alembert, they call Frederick the Solomon of the North. So the kings of the North are kind of like the Protestants here. They're kind of just giving an archetype. And the ironic thing here is Barwell notes that out of all these kings of the North, meaning the Protestant territories, they didn't even bother to try to evangelize George III with their philosophy, which Barwell says points out as a testament to his Christianity. Because King George III, if you actually read about him, he was actually, even if he's Protestant, he was very adamant about his Christian life. So it's ironic that Britain's the source of all of this stuff, but now they have the most Christian Protestant king in Britain. So, you know, again, it's just kind of very strange how you have all these exceptions. And I call that, you know, God's irony, where you have to make distinctions. You can't be too sweeping with the accusations because of situations like this. And of course, that's obviously who the American revolutionaries are rebelling against. So the other thing I would mention just in this map here, these are just all the areas where they're active for various reasons. I have a list of the princes there. In Denmark and Sweden, there's royalty. Catherine the Great's being influenced. She's kind of having like an affair with the King of Poland.
So these are all just Masonic cells of some kind.
These are all where their philosophy is spreading to, and people are being accepting of these ideas.
Okay.
And in the Dutch area, that's where they're getting a lot of stuff printed. Geneva and Switzerland's kind of like where they flee when they get in trouble in France. It's like a revolutionary refuge, if you will. Ironically, that's where a lot of the Calvinists or the Huguenots or whatever were fleeing to as well. And so this just shows like the main areas. And there's a quote that Voltaire gives on page 111, where he writes that at present, there is not a German prince who is not a philosopher. So you can see in Germany, there's all kinds of, you know, princely areas or figures that are influenced here. So
when he says they're a philosopher, he's saying just protecting.
He's saying they're receptive to our ideas.
Okay.
Yeah. And basically they're being de-Christianized, essentially. Whether they believe that's happening to them or not, if they're just being dupes, that's kind of irrelevant. The point is they're allowing this stuff to spread and be promoted.
Oh, you know what? I want to, again, with the British, I wanted a quick note, because you put on your map the fact that the 1717 origin date is really when the Whig masonry overtakes the Jacobite masonry, because there's actually a Catholic masonry, which is interesting. There's like a, because the Jacobite movement, there are these actual Catholics who are trying to meet in secret to overthrow the usurper. But that's
actually part of some of this too. That's a bit more complicated, so I was going to kind of not focus on that as much.
Sure, go ahead.
But I will say that masonry like Albert Pike and Madame Blavatsky, they hate that kind of masonry. Madame Blavatsky especially, she just rants against Jacobite masonry, or, you know, that kind of stuff. So there is a distinction to be made, but yes, the Whigs overtake it, but you're going to see that overtaken as well in Germany, and the Bavarian Illuminati merging with the more esoteric Masonry is going to kind of fulfill that as well.
But the point is that the Masonry is not a huge bureaucracy that's all controlled together in one unified system. It's yeah. all these different movements which are sort of vaguely connected by generals' ideas, but there's also divisions among them. Some of them are even Catholic, so it's just
yeah, and it doesn't start getting condemned by the papacy until it turns into that
yeah
that version that we know of it today. Anyway, so the other thing to know is that most of these people involved, surprise surprise, all seem to have adulterous relationships in their lives. Voltaire and Freddie have more daddy issues. D'Alembert and Rousseau have more mother issues. Again, if you read accounts of their life, it's you have sympathies with their upbringing and how it must have been, you know, pretty rough to go through that, but it becomes problematic when you turn into the oppressor yourself, right? And so I would advise people to read the Britannica encyclopedia entries on all these figures, and you're just going to find this glowing praise for how smart they are, they're challenging social norms, they're advancing science, they're just amazing. And then compare that with some of the stuff that we'll go through here. And I'll give a quick example of just kind of an irony that doesn't seem so reasonable to me. D'Alembert, he was left on the porch of a Catholic church by his mother. She abandoned him. That's why he's named Jean-Laurent D'Alembert, because the church was Saint Jean-Laurent. So that was like a custom. And his mother was Claudine Guérin de Tencin. She was actually a Salonist host. So she was an Enlightenment socialite, and she was writing novels. She was hosting people like Montesquieu. She was more of like the British classical liberal types, it would seem, that she was entertaining. She was also the mistress of a cardinal. So it's interesting. You would think it might be more rational to rebel against the Enlightenment principles, because that's what your mother was attached to and abandoned you for, rather than rebel against the Catholic Church, which actually raised D'Alembert and educated him. But that doesn't end up happening. So I'm just going to go through summarize some of the chapters here, what you'll find. Chapter one, Voltaire says, quote, he would prefer to die on a heap of Christians immolated at his feet. People can say, oh, he's just being poetic, right?
Very, very poetic indeed.
Yeah. Chapter two, Voltaire wants to, and I'm sourcing from his letters here. Voltaire wants to rally the, quote, atheists, deists, and Spinozists to fight against the, quote, unquote, wretch of Christendom. So when they say crush the wretch, they're basically saying crush Bourbon France, a Christendom, you know, Catholic unification of church and state, right? And then he creates an idol out of Julian the Apostate, where he, quote, wishes to hate what Julian hated and despise what Julian would have despised. So if there's any groups that he thinks Julian the Apostate wouldn't like, he'd say, we're not going to like them either. He's kind of like his muse, I guess. And then Voltaire starts bragging about their Enlightenment propaganda spreading, where he says, quote, there are but a few beggarly fellows who believe in the consubstantial in Geneva, where the fooleries of John Calvin came from. So here he's bashing Calvin as fooleries, but he's going to be seen as a champion for Huguenot rights later on. So this is the proxy warrior effect, what we'll elaborate on more. So people aren't believing in the Trinity, and they're all fools who do that anyways. He also says, quote, that English truths were even spreading in the Anglican Church. And he says, quote, in London, Christ is spurned. So these are all, he's like using this as rallying cries. Look how successful we're being, guys. He writes D'Alembert in a letter and says that England and Switzerland were overrun with those who, quote, hated and despised Christianity as Julian the Apostate hated and despised it, and that from Geneva to Bern, there was not a Christian to be found. Now, how true this is, I don't know, but, you know, they always like to say that we're much more successful than we are. I'm just saying that this is their own words. Then Frederick the Great chimes in a letter, and he says, quote, in our Protestant countries, we go on much brisker. So he's identifying the Protestants are being much more receptive to this Enlightenment. Now, here's where it gets really interesting. Voltaire calls the Huguenots, quote, raving mad, and he says that there was nothing more ill-tempered and, quote, ferocious than the Huguenots, even in comparison to the Sorbonnes, which is the Catholic theology school, or just Catholics in general. So he's saying the most raving mad Christians are the Huguenots, and they're ill-tempered. You prod them a little bit, they'll go attack. And now it's interesting that you're going to see them bragging about trying to get the Protestants recalled into France. So if he thinks they're raving mad and easily irritable and you want to bring them into France, it's not because he likes them, right? He wants to sow discord. And then you'll see D'Alembert bragging about this in his own letter, where this is his vision of France in the future. He says, quote, "I see things in the brightest colors, with a toleration of Huguenots established, the Protestants recalled into France, with the priests married, confession abolished, and fanaticism crushed," and here's the most important bit, "without its being perceived." So this is his plan. They want to bring the Huguenots in. They want to get priests married, stop confession, crush the wretch, but not be perceived that they're doing it. They don't want to be held responsible for it. Voltaire reveals, quote, "that they never intended to enlighten housemaids and shoemakers. We leave them to the apostles." So the lower class idiots, they're for the Christians. We don't want to enlighten them. He calls them the rabble. We're just going to enlighten the aristocracy. And he says, quote, "in a short time, the rabble will follow the standard of our enemies," meaning they'll be Christians. "However," he says, "that the rabble we equally despise, whether for or against us." So even if the rabble, the shoemakers and the housemaids, if they were to promote Enlightenment principles, we still despise them. That's what he's saying. So this is like, you know, the liberals in power now who don't give, you know, a what about the regular people, but they don't mind if the regular people promote their ideas. They still despise them nonetheless. You could probably see how that tradition has never really changed. And then moving on to chapter 3, this is where you get like Masonic rhetoric kind of infused into their rallying cries. If you read Masonry, they'll talk a lot about the mysteries of Mithras and Egypt, right? Oh, Egyptian wisdom, right? It all goes back to Egypt. So Voltaire tells us, quote, "that the mysteries of Mithras will not be divulged." So they have the mysteries of Mithras. They're not going to divulge them to the profane. "And that the monster," which is Christendom here, quote, "must fall and be pierced by 100 invisible hands. Yes, let it fall beneath 1,000 repeated blows." So they're going to attack Christendom with 1,000 invisible hands. Doesn't really sound like they just want to have a few reforms, right? They're just not reforming some abuses here, as we're led to believe. Voltaire also commands his adepts, quote, "to confound the wretch to the utmost of your power. Speak your mind boldly, but when you strike, conceal your hand." So proclaim the gospel of philosophy from the rooftops, but when you actually attack, don't let them know you're attacking. Conceal your hand. He says, quote, "you may be well known that I am willing to believe that people are sufficiently keen-scented," I think he's referring to the Jesuits here, for sniffing out their shenanigans. He says, "but they will not be able to convict you." So is this like saying plausible deniability? If you strike and conceal while you strike, then all the keen-scented Catholics won't be able to convict you. And then to wrap up the chapter, he invokes more Masonic Egyptian mysteries rhetoric, where he says, quote, "the Nile is said to spread around its fertilizing waters, though it conceals its head. Do you the same, and you will secretly enjoy your triumph. We embrace the worthy knight and exhort him to conceal his march from the enemy." So fertilize Christendom with the Egyptian wisdom, if you will. And that's what a worthy knight does. He does it in secret. So apparently that's what chivalry is to them, attacking in secret.
So what is Voltaire's Masonic identity? Is he some kind of grand wizard or whatever? What is he?
He's just taking what he learned in Britain, bringing it over. He doesn't get officially initiated into Masonry at the very end of his life. But my point is, this is no different what you read in Masonic literature. I could read this and it might as well be Albert Pike making these analogies. That's my point. So the idea is that they're invoking the wisdom of Egypt. So this is very biblical, right? The Israelites are not supposed to succumb to Egyptian ways. And that's exactly what's happening. So my point is, it's a grander thing that if the fallen angels are orchestrating this, they're just doing the same thing, right? And It would be timeless for Catholics to be like, well, he's talking about Egypt being cool and the mysteries of Mithras. Maybe that's a problem, right? So that's kind of my point, is the rhetoric is basically synonymous. but the different people might be using it for different reasons. And it's all like this kind of like archetypal rallying cries, if you will. And they are defining who the enemy is. And so that shows an overlap of just like what you might find in Masonic writings with Voltaire himself. And like I said, he's initiated later into the Nine Sisters at the end of his life. Then in chapter four, they're formulating the encyclopedia as a propaganda tool to try to bring all this gnosis into one body of knowledge. And it's very useful because they can make things pretty orthodox in some sections, but in others insert more Masonry. And over time, they just keep adding more and more Masonic type stuff or anti-Christian stuff. And, you know, not everyone's going to be able to read through thousands of volumes of this. So it's a great way to attack it. And so he said, D'Alembert in a letter is speaking of the encyclopedia here. And he says, quote, "If mankind grow enlightened, it is because we have used the caution to enlighten them by degrees." So the Masonic degree system, you enlighten them by degrees. And D'Alembert saying the encyclopedia, which is for, you know, everybody, is going to be enlightened by degrees. So basically, like, the point is that you don't have to be in a Masonic society to be, quote unquote, enlightened by degrees. This is just happening in academia without people knowing it. That's kind of my point here. Everybody's kind of going to be living in a Masonic system. And when you read about the weird stuff in, like, you know, Kabbalah and Masonry and all that stuff, people think that that's separate from it. But I'm saying that it's basically just coming into academia without all that overt mysticism attached to it. That's what I would be saying. There's like a fundamental connection here.
Okay.
Excellent. Moving on to chapter five, Voltaire says he wishes to, quote, "see all the Jesuits at the bottom of the sea, each with a Jansenist hung to his neck." So he's referring to the Jansenists and the Jesuits duking it out over some theological battle. I don't know exactly. I know a little bit about the Jansenist views, but nevertheless, you know, they're heretical in Catholicism. The Jesuits are fighting them. So he wants to fuel the flame of this battle because he views them as just both two sides of the same coin devouring each other.
Yeah, that was the other proxy warrior, was not only the Protestants, but the Jansenists were essentially Calvinist infiltrators into the church. They were Catholics, but they were very Calvinistic in their sensibilities and their morals, and they were reacting against the opulence of the court of the kings, you know, which was corrupted and opulent. And they were trying; they were kind of overly pious and Pharisaical, and they were condemned by the Pope for a long time. So
yeah, that seems consistent.
Yeah, so it's interesting. They're using the Huguenots, they're using the Jansenists. He despises them both. But
they're really attacking the Jesuits. The Jesuits are their number one enemy here. Yes. I want to emphasize that. And so this is interesting. D'Alembert, when the Jesuits are finally expelled, he says, quote, "I rejoice on the expulsion of the Jesuits. Japan led the way in driving out those knaves of Loyola," and he gives some other examples. Now, if you look up the Japan Jesuits, they were murdered by the emperor. So D'Alembert is rejoicing, saying Japan led the way in what to do with the Jesuits. So by default, he's saying, you know, he's fine with them being murdered and martyred by these Japanese emperors. And the idea of that the Japanese emperors, we'll talk about later with stomping on the Fumi, basically the emperor forced the Japanese people to stomp on Christ, even the ones that weren't Christian, as a response to this. It's a whole story I don't have time to get into, but it's very interesting because you might see that ritual built into one of these salons later. There's kind of a mythos about it. And when I say salons, it's just kind of like a Masonic lodge, but more, you know, well-known, I guess. And D'Alembert calls for, quote, "all monks to be swept from the face of the earth," in one of the letters. Voltaire gets in kind of a pickle because the Marquis de Pombal in Portugal, he gets caught in this anti-Jesuit conspiracy. And so he's forced to like denounce him to kind of save face, but I'm sure he's probably secretly praising him because Pombal has some connections to British Masonry as well. E. Michael Jones talks about that, I think in Jewish Revolutionary Spirit, maybe Baron Metal. So I'm not going to kind of go into a tangent there, but this one I think is really important. Frederick the Great, in a letter, he's talking about the Jesuits being expelled and what it means. And he's kind of gloating about it. And he's going to identify Voltaire as being the key instigator here. So Frederick is saying very poetically, "what an unfortunate age for the court of Rome. She's openly attacked in Poland. Her lifeguards," meaning the Jesuits, "are driven out of France and Portugal and will probably be driven out in Spain. The philosophers of Voltaire and company, they openly sap the foundations of the apostolic throne. Toleration is preached, and so all is lost. So apparently when toleration is preached, Catholicism gets lost, according to Freddie. He says, a miracle alone could save the church, and you, Mr. Voltaire, will have the pleasure of burying her. The Jesuits are driven out of the kingdom. It is said that the Holy Father, though in a rage, will be obliged to consent. So the Pope didn't really want to do this. It was forced upon him by all these monarchs. But there were philosophically inclined monarchs, let's say. He says, what are we not to expect in the next century? And he didn't live to see the Jacobin genocide, I don't think, or Napoleon coming to destroy his own kingdom later. But he seems pretty excited about what the next century brings during this time. And he says, the axe is at the root of the tree. So the tree of Christendom that's about to be chopped down. On one side, the philosophers openly attack the abuses of the sainted superstition. So he's calling Catholicism superstition. On the other hand, princes are forcing to loot the church and laying goods to the property, taking the properties and taking away the props of the trumpeters of fanaticism. So he's saying he's very happy that these goods are being taken away, and you're going to find him conspiring to do the same shortly. So fanaticism is just code word for Catholicism. And last thing, just wrap it up before you go. He says that the church is on the eve of falling, and nations shall inscribe in their annals of history that Voltaire was the promoter of the revolution effected during the 19th century in the human mind. So he is saying, Voltaire, you will be remembered for destroying the Catholic Church. And he's very happy about it.
And the Jesuits were a people. I keep on saying the Jesuits were the force. They were the army of Jesus in society at this time, all over the world. And they had dozens and dozens of schools, universities. They had tons of property. They were like their own nation within the nation. And suppressing them not only took away their influence as to the faith, but it also allowed the government to take over all of their institutions of learning, take all of their property, their money, just loot them, and then introduce their own public education system to try to re-engineer society to their liking. Because everyone was educated by Jesuits.
The ironic thing is Frederick will accept the Jesuits, but because they're good at education. So he allows them to be destroyed, but then he brings them into his territory. And so they end up getting refuge, ironically, in his area and also Catherine the Great. And we might talk about that later or maybe the next segment with the Jesuits in Russia. But the interesting thing is the Jesuits, and also this will be identified, the Jesuits and the convents preserve Catholicism the most. This is what I call the convent conspiracy. Go to chapter 6. You can read all about it. And this is where it's just so damning right here. Frederick in his own letter says, quote, the places where the convents are most numerous are the places where people are most blindly attached to superstition. So where the convents are prevalent, the people are the Catholics, they get preserved. He says, no doubt if these asylums of fanaticism were destroyed, people would grow lukewarm. So if these crazy convents of crazy Catholicism, if they were destroyed, the people would just get a lukewarm Christianity and just stop caring about it. And he says the point here would to be destroy the cloisters, at least begin by lessening their number. And then he says the time has come. Now it's the time to do this. The French and Austrian governments are involved in debts. The lure of rich abbeys and well-endowed convents is tempting. By presenting to these governments of Austria and France that these nuns don't contribute to the state, they don't procreate, because back then they actually cared about procreation to bring about population, right? Not like we do today. And they had great abuses, like just basically saying, oh, they're greedy, they're worldly, and you know, they're sexually immoral, right? He's using this to say, why don't you pay off your debts and loot these convents? And these are the excuses you can give. They don't do anything for society. And he says that I think they might adopt this plan of reform if I present it to him in this fashion. And he says that every government that shall adopt this plan will be friendly to the philosophers and the promotion or circulation of philosophical books which attack popular superstition or Catholicism will be friendly to them as well, or, this is important, the false zeal that would support it. So false opposition to Catholicism that gives, you know, straw man arguments for it so that philosophers can tear it down will allow them to be held up as well. So here he is saying the Catholic nuns preserve Catholicism in its most zealous sense, and that's a problem. So let's present to the rulers of these Catholic areas of Austria and France that they don't really do anything for society and say, why don't you loot them and take their property and put it to better use? And any government that adopts this plan, we're going to support them and spread all this Masonic philosophy and stuff like that. And then so Voltaire responds to this plan and he says, your plan of attack against superstition is worthy a great captain. And he says, but France is not yet ripe enough. Quote, the bigots are still in power. And then Frederick says, after they destroy the convents, because the Jesuits have been expelled, then they'll go after the bishops next. So it's interesting that these guys are showing you the order of importance for them. Number one, the Jesuits. Number two, the convents. And then it's the bishops. So I think that's very telling when you look at how they attack these things in the order of it.
Yeah. And another aspect of this, because you're talking about debts, and the Seven Years' War happens right at this very moment, 1756 to 1763, which is really the first World War. Over economic interests. So you have Spain, France, Britain, they're all fighting. And then they have war debts because they have to hire all these mercenaries or whatever, do all this stuff. And they've got these debts that you're talking about. And that this is actually some of the origin of the American Revolution is this war and these debts and these taxes that are trying to pay. So this economic motivation is happening. France suppresses the Jesuits immediately after the Seven Years' War, 1763, the suppression of the Jesuits is 1764.
And they're suppressed because of debt, actually. One of the Jesuits ran up a bunch of debt, Antoine de La Valette, and he was like caught working with like the Dutch merchants. It's a weird story, but that was like one of the big catalysts for them getting expelled in France.
Yeah, and the Jesuits were not all perfect. Yeah, I mean, you could just find a Jesuit who did something wrong and then use that as a pretext to suppress everything good that was going on with the Jesuits.
Exactly. When all these philosophes, these Enlightenment-fueled people run up debts, nobody cares about that, it seems. Right? So anyways, wrapping up book one, chapter 11, there's actually a primitive Zionism. It's very interesting. There's two attempts to get the Jews back into Israel or Palestine land, right? One is by Voltaire, one's by D'Alembert. The first attempt, D'Alembert appeals to Frederick the Great, and there's some like Jewish subjects in Prussia that might be on board with this. They try to work with the Sultan in Constantinople to get this to happen because he's in control of the area. It doesn't really end up happening. And then Voltaire tries to appeal to Catherine the Great to do this because there's some rebellion in Egypt. And then that rebellion might take over control. So they want to try to get the Jews back there, but strictly because they want to just discredit Christianity. Voltaire doesn't like the Jews at all. They just want to use them to attack Christianity. So here's an instance where it seems ironic that a lot of the Jews who will be favorable towards the Enlightenment because, you know, they think that the Catholic Church is anti-Semitic, but they're just being used as proxy warriors here too, if you can see what I'm saying. Like, oh yeah, let's just get them to the Israel just to discredit Christianity. And Voltaire, he's, you know, even a lot of Jewish historians will complain how he's certainly no friend to the Jews. So you can see another proxy warrior on the other side of the coin here, unfortunately. And yeah, so, you know, Zionism before it became popular, right? Then moving on, you have chapter, hold on 1 second, lost my place. Here we go. Chapter 12, Joseph II is implicated in all of this. And basically, to summarize it, Joseph II is seen as one of these enlightened despots, and he's actually Hitler's favorite Habsburg, his only favorite Habsburg. Hitler and Mein Kampf rants against the Habsburgs constantly, but Joseph II is the lone Habsburg who was adopting the Aryan way back then, because really he was just doing whatever Frederick the Great said. Any of Frederick's policies, Joseph just kind of adopted them. And so Barwell says he's basically a dupe, but he really should have known better. And there's a whole thing that goes with Joseph II. I don't have time to get into, but basically later on, everyone's trying to undo all of his policies. He's just really useful to, you know, helping advance this agenda because he becomes the Holy Roman Emperor. He was kind of co-sharing it with his mother, Maria Theresa. But then once he takes a hold, I think he's just, you know, basically adopting anything Frederick does. Because he seemed like maybe like almost like a little bit of a father figure, an uncle figure or something like that. Then in 1766, that's when Voltaire says there's not a prince in Germany who is not a philosopher. So a lot of this stuff is happening in the 1960s. Well, I guess maybe a Freudian slip in the 1760s. You know, the 60s, man, revolution. And so that's all going on during this time. And that's when they're really like very active. And then they all kind of maybe start turning on each other a bit more later, especially with like Rousseau. We'll get to him. And then here's a very telling statement. In 1775, Voltaire writes a letter to Freddie. And this is when King Louis XVI ascends to the throne. He says, quote, "I know not whether our young king will walk in your footsteps," meaning will he become an enlightened despot like you, Freddie? Or will he be a bigot for Catholicism? I don't know. But he says, "I do know that he has taken philosophers for his ministers, all except one who is unfortunately a bigot. The priests are in despair. This is the commencement of a great revolution." So who cares what Louis XVI does, if he becomes Catholic or not? He's surrounded by ministers that are all under our pocket and all friendly to philosophy, except this one unfortunate bigot at the court. I don't know exactly who he's referring to. So that shows you the state of the infiltration while Louis XVI becomes king. So this guy, he's a young king. He's surrounded by wolves. So when people want to criticize him for all these bad decisions, think about what you're surrounded by. You know, would you do better in that situation? So here's an example. Going back to the contradictory nature of all this, in chapter 14, Voltaire is courting the Landgrave of Hesse Castle, Frederick II, a different Frederick. And this guy is completely enamored with Voltaire. He converted to Catholicism, but he's still, you know, he's still in this mindset of like just being open to all this stuff. Voltaire gives him literature from one of the OG Whig influences. Well, he's a Tory, but he's promoting his ideas. Bolingbroke, Viscount Bolingbroke. He was an anti-religious Tory, basically. And he actually inspired a lot of the American revolutionaries. So this is really ironic because he's a Tory, right? And the American revolutionaries are against King George III, who's, you know, seen as more tied to the Tories who want to keep the monarch. Well, at the same time, this Frederick the Landgrave, this is the same Landgrave that farms out the Hessians to go fight the American revolutionaries.
Oh, wow.
So why is he getting the same literature that's going to foment the American Revolution just to farm out the Hessians to King George to fight them, while Voltaire later gets initiated into the Nine Sisters Lodge, which has all these American revolutionaries? So my question would be, do these guys really know what the hell they're doing? Or is it just the fallen angels orchestrating all of this, and they're killing each other. You know what I mean? You know, like we're going to farm the revolutionaries out to fight the American revolutionaries, but we're adopting the same principles as them. It's just so contradictory when you actually look at all the connections here. So
yeah, there's
a conspiracy of powers and principalities. That's what I'm trying to
answer. Yeah. They're trying to use these other people as proxy warriors, but they're all actually proxy warriors for the fallen angels.
Exactly. Exactly. Great point. And then to wrap it up, from chapter 15 on to the end, here's just some miscellaneous things that are in here. They'll falsely attribute works to avoid persecution. So they write something, but they just use pseudonyms or say a dead guy wrote this. They use all these booksellers, and they try to make the neutrality of the bookselling be like, well, we're not going to censor things because everything makes money. So this is like the free market or something. Oh, just, you know, allow all ideas, but really they're just going to make money off of it all. And who cares what they print? That's kind of like what ends up happening. It just gets diluted to financial means. Voltaire ends up like bashing the actual philosophers they're appealing to, where Socrates, he says, would die for his beliefs, but we're smarter than that. We're not going to die for our beliefs. That's crazy, right? So he thinks they think themselves better than these ancient philosophers even. Then they are trying to infiltrate all these institutions. They're trying to get their own inside guys in here. This is all, you know, various letters throughout show this. And then more importantly, the public education aspect actually comes about from this guy, Baron de Holbach's salon. He's kind of like an atheist extraordinaire. And he's got this whole group that meets all these capitalist type Whig Mason types are frequenting it. There's a rumor that to enter this lodge, you had to stomp on a cross on the floor to enter. Now, whether that's true or not, I don't know, but that's what the Japanese emperor was forcing everybody to do. I wouldn't be surprised. Right. And so these people have this whole plan where they want to give like free or cheap education to the so-called rabble of the countryside. And they tell them, oh, this is to train you for your field better of farming or mechanics or shoemaking or whatever. But really, it's just them indoctrinating them with all the Enlightenment principles. And it's really little to focus on the trades that they actually probably would have just learned within their families. So now apparently they need to illuminate the rabble because they realize that they need them. So there's this whole elaborate scheme running from this salon with a variety of different examples of evidence Barwell gives to show how they were basically formulating this primitive public education. The last thing I mentioned is they're all very bipolar. There's moments where they're questioning what they're doing. Do we believe in God or not? They don't seem so confident and proud in some of their letters. And at the end of their lives, some of them are, Voltaire has these weird accounts where he might want to, he confesses to die in the Catholic Church. He actually wrote that. He had a confession and then he kind of got better. And then he got initiated to Masonry after that. It's just very back and forth. It's kind of like an angel and demon tugging at him during this time. There's a lot of very bizarre rants. He's talking about receiving the sacrament and he's saying, D'Alembert, don't you chastise me for receiving the sacrament. But he says, you don't know if he's receiving it as like, he's just being hostile. It's just very bipolar. And it's just kind of sad to read. It's just, you know, you see the dismal state of their soul in some of these writings. And so there's kind of this conspiracy at the end. There's a lot of mythos around it. I don't have time to get into it, but they seem to be preventing each other from going to get last rites because they don't want to see their hero succumb to Catholicism at the end of their life. So there's a lot of strange stuff. And again, you can read about that in the latter parts. But with that being said, I can move on to book two, but I'm sure you probably want to.
Somebody was asking about the Pope condemning, and shout out to David Gray. He wrote the Catholic Catechism of Freemasonry, and he goes through just all the papal condemnations of Freemasonry and just analyzes them, comments on them. And according to him, the first condemnation of Freemasonry is In Eminenti, 1738, Clement XII. And then there's Providas Romanorum, 1751, Benedict XIV. And then there's the condemnations ramp up later in the 19th century, but there's already these condemnations. And some of these were not published in certain areas. I read that in Ireland, they actually didn't publish these. And so the great Catholic politician, Daniel O'Connell, he initially joined a Masonic lodge unknowing. And so did Joseph de Maistre. So these good Catholic men were involved in Freemasonry initially. They didn't even realize it.
Yeah, that's funny because Barwell gets like this forced pseudo-initiation on him that he gives an account on later. So if you ever hear people calling Barwell a Mason, that's what's referring to. I'll talk about that in a little bit. But moving on to book two, if we got like about a half hour left or something, I can probably hopefully get it all in here. So book two is about the anti-monarchical conspiracy. And basically the idea is that the foundations to destroy religion bring about the logical conclusion of destroying the monarchy that's claiming to be upholding the social kingship of Christ, right? Here's a quote that one of these revolutionaries gives. The kings are like Saturn in heathen mythology. They devour their own children. So you might ask if that's just a projection here where all these revolutionaries are going to devour each other and their children will devour them. But nevertheless, there's that Saturnine archetype that they apply that we talked about being so important to all that occult Gnosticism, right? And transmuting the so-called dark lead of Saturn, the Dark Ages. So this brings us to the dialectic of Montesquieu and Rousseau, where Montesquieu is kind of like, you know, nobility, but he's not like super nobility. So the idea is that every single class is just jealous of the one above it. That's kind of how I describe it. So Rousseau represents more like the third estate, the people, right? So all of the more classical liberal, or maybe like what people might call, you know, conservative or whatever. And I'm not trying to use that to be a jerk. I'm just saying like that's just to identify with things today. Might be more akin to Montesquieu. Now, Barwell is very respectful towards Montesquieu, but he's still kind of baffled at some of the things he promotes. And basically, Montesquieu's beef is with the monarchy, and he doesn't really say too much against religion. It's more against monarchy. And then Rousseau kind of runs with the ideas of the anti-monarch people, but he gets into like a more, much more radical version of it that we would probably recognize today. So I would say that Rousseau is kind of like the leftist SJWs who are kind of irrational, wildly contradictory. And Montesquieu's the more, you know, like you said, classical Masonic liberal type. And then Rousseau ends up turning on Voltaire later. But the funny thing is, even though they start like getting cranky towards each other, they all still promote each other's works when it's convenient to attack Catholicism. So does that sound familiar today, right? So anyways, Rousseau, here's another interesting example, one of the personages in the background kind of influencing them. He grew up in the Calvinist Republic of Geneva, where, as far as I understand, Calvinism was more legalistic. They cared about law and order, where, you know, it's like the opposite of Luther, which is more, you know, open borders, chaos, right? And so he's growing up in a more, perhaps, like you said, Pharisaical environment. If you look up him in the Britannica dictionary, they'll say of Rousseau that, quote, he propelled political and ethical thinking. He taught parents to educate their children differently, and he made liberty an almost universal aspiration of objects. So educating your children differently, ethically, and universally, that's kind of what Whig history is saying Rousseau is responsible for. Now, we will ask you if you think what he's doing here is very ethical. You can decide. But nevertheless, he grew up with a Republican father who was in Geneva, but he was appealing more to the republics of Rome or Sparta or whatever, right? This is kind of like people like Petrarch going back to the pagan republics. And he got in trouble with the law in Geneva, so he actually fled. I think he ended up in the Ottoman Empire. So he wasn't around. And Rousseau didn't like his mother's family, so he ended up fleeing Geneva to France, and he converts to Catholicism. Now, it's interesting. His conversion mainly happened because of this Baroness de Warens. She actually fled Switzerland to France and converted to Catholicism. But when she did it, she, quote, stripped her husband of his money before fleeing there with the gardener's son. That's from Britannica. So she stole the money from her husband to flee to France. She went off with the gardener's son as kind of like her boy toy. And then Rousseau will just become her next victim. So she's basically a sexual predator, and she starts a missionary in France to help convert young Protestant boys to Catholicism. In other words, she's just trying to be a sexual predator, and Rousseau became one of these victims. So he's in an adulterous relationship with this woman, and they're both from a Calvinist background converting to Catholicism, but not adhering to the morality. So that's kind of his background here. He also kind of had an alternative road to Damascus moment, but it was the road to Vincennes, where he had an illumination about the noble savage doctrine. And I'll talk about this. I'm sourcing this from Britannica, where he basically realized that modern civilization and its progress was bad, whether it's the Whig Masonic version or, you know, the Catholic version. He wants the SJW version, right? And so he says basically that, quote, people are good by nature, but have been corrupted by society and civilization. He did not mean to suggest that society and civilization are inherently bad, but he deplored the direction that European culture had taken since the Middle Ages. His belief was that people were naturally good, and this became the cornerstone of his argument. So the rock of the noble savage is that people are naturally good, inverting original sin. And we're going to see this with Adam Weishaupt later. He's running on Rousseau. And the Dark Ages brought about all the problems that we deal with today. That's basically the rock of the noble savage dogma that obviously lends to, you know, SJWs getting cranky about colonialism, right? So you can see how the left we deal with today, really, Rousseau is kind of like the basis for it. Now, here's what's really ironic. In chapter two, Barrowell gives you writings from one of Rousseau's adepts, one of the people who's enamored with Rousseau. And this is after the revolution has taken place. And basically, he gives you Rousseau's writings on what a happy nation is. So according to Rousseau, this is a happy nation. When you have population growth and you don't inflate it with immigration numbers, meaning you close your borders to immigration and you grow your population by people in your own nation, that brings about the happiness of a nation. So do you see how ironic it is that the liberal left that says open borders, everything, and having children is horrible? That Rousseau's own standards said the opposite back during this time. And here's the other ironic thing, that this adept of Rousseau, he decides to calculate, based on Rousseau's criteria, the population of France under Louis XIV, which they're all calling the despotic evil king. And they find that France is a, quote, prodigy among all the nations of Europe, where they're having the most population growth and all this stuff. And despite all the polemics against the Bourbon regime, they actually had a lot going for it by Rousseau's own criteria. And so the funny thing is that this adept, after admitting that France was a bastion of liberty under Rousseau's standards, under the Bourbon monarchy, he, in his delusion, he says, well, we're going to take the liberty and equality principles and we're going to perfect them and make it even better, after it just genocided the whole population. So just the contradictory nature of this stuff is just so, like, mind-blowing when you read it. And that probably makes sense why, you know, the left tradition seems to harken back to Rousseau, and they've completely inverted even his own criteria for a happy nation with open borders and infanticide, right? So I just thought that was
very interesting. Yeah. For the revolutionaries, it is voluntarism. Truth is the opinion of the powerful. It doesn't matter what you say. It just matters who's in power. Just give me more power. I don't care what I say to justify it.
Exactly. And you're going to see this with the funny thing is he fled Geneva, right, to go to France. And then they all take the revolution to Geneva and they overthrow the republic that's more tied to Calvinism. The same thing happened in the Dutch Republic, where it was more Protestant. And then they start making it more egalitarian and stuff like that. And then there's even a chapter in chapter 6 showing how Voltaire is known for being, like, more favorable to monarchy. You know, he's entertaining all the monarchs. He's not known as, like, radically egalitarian, but apparently in his latter years, he started being more like that. And I think it's because all the revolutionaries are evolving into that. And now it's like, well, if I don't go along with them, they're going to turn on me. So this is where, like, you have the Democrats who are older now, they have to keep conceding to the more radicals in order to stay in power and not be eaten up by them. So I think you kind of see that happening with Voltaire, and you're going to see this, like, weird egalitarian takeover of Geneva during this time by all these revolutionaries. So that's all in chapter 6. Then you get into later the more esoteric masonry, the really the interesting stuff. In chapter 9, that's Barwell's forced initiation. It's like a super peer pressure thing where they, like, all these people grab Barwell, they bring him to this, like, initiation. They're trying to force it upon him. But the way he describes it, it's more like the comedic and theatrical version of it that you might see on, like, YouTube, when, like, it's just kind of, like, silly. But it is creepy at the same time, the way it's all described. So I don't know. Look up, like, a Hiram Abiff initiation on modern day masonry, and you might get a glimpse into what it might have looked like. And so Barwell basically says that these theatrics, this is, like, silly nonsense, so that the people who like that, they just stay there. And then the people who think this is stupid and they want something more, they start getting into the advanced degrees, the more intellectual ones. So again, we talked about this last time. This is like college fraternities where it's like toga, toga, and you're just drinking and partying. That's the theatrical version. But then the Skull and Bones, or maybe like Carl Sagan's Sphinx Head societies, stuff like that, they're the ones who are going to be the movers and shakers that are going to be, you know, the real people behind some of these societies and the advanced parts of it. So you can just see that kind of schema formulating here in a lot of ways. And, you know, you see it in Hollywood, right? You get the Hangover movies or Animal House versus like the Fight Club or Matrix or Pi, which are more deeper, esoteric and psychologically stimulating, stuff like that. Think about media and political theater, right? Media ratings, they just pump out whatever works, but behind the scenes, they don't really care. They just want power, ratings and money, stuff like that. And so you could see that exoteric, esoteric schema, kind of the foundation of it going into all these different versions of society, in my opinion. And so in chapters 10 and 11, this is where whatever's written in these degrees, it just sounds like what I read in Blavatsky and Albert Pike and all these Masons. And basically, this would be the advanced degrees based on Philo of Alexandria, like we talked about, what Masonry says its advanced degrees are based upon. And you'll see a lot of interesting overlap with what we already talked about here. But here's the interesting bit. This is where it starts connecting the story of Hiram Abiff, where he's like this master mason who's assassinated. And then they need to, the Masons need to enact revenge on him. And then they say that Jacques de Molay of the Knights Templar, the leader, he's like a new Hiram Abiff. And the King of France and the Pope conspired. They're like the assassins of Hiram. So it's the, it's interesting. This is an inversion of the books, right? The anti-Christian conspiracy, the anti-monarchical conspiracy, and the anti-social conspiracy. That's how Barwell titles these things. And that's what these three assassins represent: the church and the Pope, the state with Philip the Fair, and then the Catholic society. So interestingly, he gives you the inverted Masonic schema in his memoirs. It's kind of funny. So these are the groups that you're taught, the Masons are taught, that conspire to kill Hiram and then later Jacques de Molay. And so they start viewing this, these people as like kind of like crucified saviors in a way. And this is the schema. People like Hiram Abiff, they have this word, this divine word of masonry, perhaps a logos, right? Like Philo we talked about. And it's the lost word of Jehovah, but it's not like Jehovah as, you know, the exoteric God of Israel, Jehovah, right? This is the pantheistic Jehovah. That's the unity of the natural religion. And Christ, it says, I'm going to read some quotes here from what these Masonic degrees are revealing. Christ himself, in their eyes, is the destroyer of the unity of God. He is the great enemy of Jehovah. He thereby learns that on the day which the word Jehovah was lost is precisely on that which the Son of God, dying on the cross for salvation of mankind, consummated the grand mystery of our religion, destroyed the reign of every other order, whether Judaic, natural, or sophistical. So basically what he's saying is that this multicultural, all religions are one under this pantheistic Jehovah, that was lost when Christ was crucified and the Catholic Church took over. That's the profane version of understanding this. And so Christ, under that understanding, is the destroyer of the unity of mankind. And to recover the lost word that was lost because of the Catholic Church destroying it, that's tied to Hiram Abiff, essentially. And that equality and liberty are the two pillars of this lost word. And this is where the degrees, the advanced degrees, this is what the initiates start learning. And so when you get to the Knights Kadosh degree, which is very similar to what Albert Pike reveals in chapter 30 of Morals and Dogma, a very revealing chapter, this is where they start fomenting the initiate as being an assassin. You will avenge the death of Jacques de Molay. And guess what? The King of France killed him. And guess what? Louis XVI is his successor. And again, it's not overtly said, but these things are naturally suggesting this, right? And so when they're getting all juiced up in revolutionary fervor, and then they start thinking the King of France is evil, and this is my Masonic tradition, this is a secret, what are they going to do? They're going to go after the King of France. And ironically, they imprison Louis XVI in what's called the Tower of the Temple, which was an ancient Templar castle. But it was just kind of like, it seemed like more of a museum, a relic, but they specifically made it into a prison to hold him until the execution. Why would they do that if not influenced by this stuff, right? So this might relate to some of the weird overlap with the Templar strangeness. Based on that question one of your chat members asked a while back on the Templars, I actually read through Barber's work recently, most of it on the Templars. There's some weird parallels. I know that modern history is going to tell you that, you know, Philip the Fair was, you know, he trumped up these charges and confiscated the goods. And there is evidence, obviously, that he was confiscating this or that. I'm not trying to exonerate him per se, but I'm just saying that there is another side of the story that's very weird in conjunction with a lot of this stuff. And I just kind of summarize a few things here.
And what were you just quoting, Michael?
This was the chapters where chapter.
So it was Barwell, right?
Yeah. He's okay. This is what the Masonic degrees are telling the initiates.
Okay.
So he has copies of various degrees and he's giving you the information for them.
Okay.
And like I said, a lot of this just corresponds with what I read in terms of the rhetoric in Albert Pike's masonry, stuff like that. So these Templars are supposed to be like super Gnostic elite occultists, and that's good in their eyes, right? And so that's what they're saying that you're appealing to. And so it's interesting if you read Barber's book, a lot of the more extreme cases of the accusations that get against the Templars are in southern France. Surprise, surprise. Also, I'd say that Barwell also has a chapter talking about this as well, giving his viewpoint on the Templar debacle. Philip the Fourth, whatever you say about his other things of confiscating goods, I'm just separating those instances. He did say that if the Templars were found guilty, the goods would be donated to like the Crusades and the church or monastic orders. He wasn't going to just take them and use them for his kingdom. That was deliberated in both Barber's book and what Barwell says in his history. You can argue that maybe he was just trying to hold on to them and trying to find a way to get them somehow, but you know, that's not in the writings, you know, specifically. Philip the Fair is also maintaining the Inquisition, and there's a book, an academic book, that says, quote, he wanted to be sure that those who were punished were heretics, but that the punishments weren't excessive. So he's trying to maintain the Inquisition, but not have it be abusive. Now, here's the interesting thing. The Templars who confessed, they all kind of confessed right at the beginning. Now, people will say, well, it's because they were tortured. Fair enough. But if they confess to a priest, that's a sacrament, right? Now, if they say, well, we recant our confessions, you're actually denying the sacrament of confession, right? See what I'm saying? There's a theological problem there. It's like you're saying, I got the Eucharist, but like I renounced getting the Eucharist that one time in a way, right? So you're saying that you lied in the sacrament of confession. Now, you know, you could say, well, there were torture, there was duress. Okay, understandable. But what's interesting is after they recant from their confessions, like the confessions are all very consistent. And to have that coordinate across all of Europe, it seems very strange that they're so consistent. The one thing that differs is this weird story of the head idol. There's a lot that goes with that. But nevertheless, once they recant their testimonies, that's when they start getting inconsistent and bipolar and kind of acting very similar, in my opinion, to how you see Voltaire and some of these people acting, where they just seem like they're caught in two worlds. It's very bizarre. And so they say that we have always been Orthodox. We would have died for the faith in the Muslim territories. We would have been killed for it. We would have rotted in prison. We would have been tortured. And my question is, well, if you say you do that for the faith in Muslim territories, why didn't you do that when you were rounded up in the Catholic territories? I can't imagine that the Catholic tortures would have been much worse than the Muslim tortures if they were in their prisons. So that seems very odd to me. These are just points that like Barwell brings up as well in some level. I'm just saying these are questions to ask. In the final analysis, I can see it both ways. It is interesting, though, that Barber says that modern history, ever since like the 1940s, no serious historian says that they were guilty of any of these charges. But before that, people might say that they were guilty. So it's interesting that also Barber reveals that a lot of people have colored their viewpoint of the Templars based upon events in modern history, like World War II, and saying, oh, Philip the Fair's takeover is kind of like a fascist takeover, like Hitler or something, right? So it's like they're trying to compare authoritarianism as we would know it in the modern world with what happened with the Templars and make it a one-to-one equation. So it's kind of interesting, but I'd say read chapter 12 on this if you want to get Barwell's take and some of the points that he makes about it. But nevertheless, what's more important here is that in chapter 13, this is the Cathar connection. Condorcet, who again, I think he was Voltaire's biographer, he's one of these aristocracy folks. He writes this work called The Table of Progress of the Human Mind. And basically he's saying that the Masonic Enlightenment connects back to the Cathars. And they were these tolerant people who promoted the doctrines of reason, and that the evil Catholic Church took them out. They were ambitious. The Crusade was horrible. The Inquisition is horrible. And these were just, you know, liberal progressives, basically. And so then Barwell says that Condorcet is the one who connects this all to them, and that these Masonic degrees all stem back to Manes of Manichaean dualism. And this ties into the Widow's Son, where the Widow's Son, Hiram Abiff is seen as like the Widow's Son and stuff like that. And Mani or Manes or whatever you call him, he started this society called the Son of the Widow in the 3rd century. And even the Freemasonic dictionary admits this. So it really, the whole thing about the Widow's Son and Hiram Abiff, the Manes or Manes or whatever, how you pronounce it, he's the source of that mythos. So it all goes back to that Manichaean dualism. That's the point. Like all this esoteric masonry and this Cathar stuff, he's saying that these guys are identifying it by default as going back to these Manichaean dualists that we went over way back when. So it is interesting that he says he's sorry to say, to reveal the secret, that this is what it all goes back to. So that kind of wraps up that part. I'll get onto the Bavarian Illuminati, try to go through as quickly as possible. I don't know if you wanted to respond to any of that.
Oh, sure. No, just keep on going. I know we've got about 15 more minutes. Certainly. Yeah,
I think I can get through it. So book three and four are on the Illuminati. More specifically, book three is like the actual doctrines, and book four is just kind of like a history summarizing everything. Now, it's interesting, in the Catholic Encyclopedia, they tell you that Adam Weishaupt supposedly reconciled with the Catholic Church later. I don't know what reconciled means, but he did donate money to try to build a church. So if he was received back into the church, I'd say that's a big victory considering all the stuff that he was writing during these times.
And Weishaupt's the founder of the Illuminati.
Yes.
Right.
Right. So okay. 1776, right? That famous year. Now, the main figures in the Bavarian Illuminati is Weishaupt. He's more of like the scientific rationalist. There's a Baron von Knigge. They call him Philo, ironically. It's his code name. He was a Mason, and he was like kind of dabbled in the esoteric arts, it would seem. Maybe he got into like some ritual magic. He was kind of back and forth between natural masonry and maybe more mystical ones. And then there's an adept, a Mason named Bode. These three guys are kind of fundamental to fusing the Illuminati with masonry, the more esoteric masonry in Germany. Now, the interesting thing is they're all suspicious of each other being crypto Jesuits or priests. They're really paranoid about the Jesuits. And then it kind of fuses into a whole new animal. Weishaupt kind of loses control, and he kind of gets, seems like he gets on the run. So it just turns into a whole nother animal. So I wouldn't blame everything on Adam Weishaupt. We're talking about, again, the ideas and all that kind of stuff, right? And even Baron von Knigge accuses Adam Weishaupt of quote unquote Jesuitism later. Because he's being super dogmatic. And so they start using code words for cities, like Munich becomes Athens. Their adepts are named again, like Philo, Hermes Trismegistus. There's an adept named Pico della Mirandola. Right? So that's like their alter egos or something, I guess. So basically the Illuminati doctrines, it's kind of like the noble savage on steroids. They want to infiltrate academia. They're promoting the abolition of private property, national borders. They're saying stealing is fine if the ends are virtuous. They're psychologically profiling everything. It's all very psychologically based. And they're really traumatizing the people below. So it kind of sounds like leftist universities today, right? Not really much different. And the only thing is they were much more attached to sexual morality during these times. And speaking of which, we'll get to the Weishaupt's dilemma shortly with abortion. On page 490, Weishaupt talks about the secret doctrine of Jesus Christ. So here is how he keeps the dogma of Jesus Christ as savior and the dogma of original sin, but he inverts the meaning. And he says, quote, "This is the explanation of Christ the savior being the liberator of the world. Now the doctrine of original sin or the fall of man, or of the fall of man and his regeneration, this is how it can be understood. The state of pure nature, meaning before Catholicism, or of fallen and corrupt nature in the state of grace, this is how you understand it. Mankind, he quit his original state of liberty, his original Garden of Eden. And this is under the natural equality before Christianity, the Dark Ages Christianity took over. And now in the civil governments and Catholic society and everything that they're seeing, and they don't like the Masonic society either, of like the Whig products or, you know, capitalist establishment too. This is where you see some of the Rousseau stuff coming in. Now mankind can't live in this state of pure nature, and the corrupt fallen system has imposed itself upon us. So he's conflating Catholicism and the Dark Ages, so-called, as being one and the same with like this corrupt secular Masonic system on some level. So it's more, again, more of an SJW vibe. And that's the state of mankind. The fall was when the Catholic Church took over, right? That's kind of like the analogy he's drawing here. And so on page 493, he also says of this, kind of expanding upon the same principles, quote, "The Illumini is to be taught that soon the doctrine of Christ was falsified after this fall, and then the Catholic Church took root and became the government. and that priests and philosophers raised on these divine foundations are an edifice of folly, prejudice, and self-interest. And soon also the tyranny of the priesthood and the despotism of princes coalesce, and the oppression and suffering of humanity is a result of the Catholic Empire. And thus, to rectify this, to remedy this problem, he recommends to, quote, study the doctrines of the ancient Gnostics and Manichaeans, which may lead the initiate to find more important discoveries on real masonry. And so it's under the real masonry of the Gnostics and the Manichaeans that they will alleviate and get rid of the oppression of the princes and the priesthood. So there you go. It's based upon Gnostic Manichaean dualism, right? And so lastly, I wanted to bring in more stuff on the Jesuits in particular. Basically, they promote the Illuminati promotes end justify the means doctrines, but they say don't do it in the bad way like the Jesuits do it, basically. So they say that if a commander gives a command and it seems unscrupulous, the initiate should always remember that there is a goodness of the means that is always preserved in that command. And of the Jesuits, they say to, quote, avoid them like the plague. In chapter 9 of book 4, this is really important. Again, this is chapter 9 of the final book. Jesuit masonry, this idea that the Jesuits were corrupting masonry, this was invented by them to scare the Protestants in Germany in particular. And also it kind of went over into England, I guess, and other areas. It's to scare them out of the Blue Lodge masonry, the type of masonry that says, you know, the Christian God is good, country and borders are good, you know, right? The upright Masons just want to preserve God and country. It was designed to get rid of them. And so when you say that the Jesuits created those more Catholic degrees or Christian degrees, that's going to scare them because they're all afraid of the Jesuits. So they either quit Masonry altogether, or they come into the occult degrees where they start learning everything we just talked about, the noble savage on steroids. So this really just worked like a charm. And it's because the Protestants got triggered by anything Jesuit that they actually went into more occultism because of it. And so this is so relevant to today because people still do this. They still talk about the Catholic Church or the Jesuits creating the Illuminati and the Freemasons. And it's horrible and evil and awful, but they're actually falling for an Illuminati trick. It's just so ironic. And so this chapter goes through that. And there's another passage later when somebody during the time protested Barwell's memoirs. And of course, he's coming from a Protestant Anglican background who's kind of getting mixed in with supporting the American revolutionaries. And he just kind of falls for the same thing in his criticisms. And here's the interesting thing. Here's a quote from one of these people trying to formulate the degrees. When they're trying to make a more Christian degree, they say, quote, I mean that it should be a completely Jesuitical piece. Not a single word should be found in it that can be objected to by religious or political governments, meaning Catholic social kingship. Let us act with caution. And when we write in our degree, imbecile monks, instead of saying imbecile monks, say imbecile men, right? And instead of writing princes and priests are in our way, we're just going to remove that. So they're making more Catholic degrees and saying, write it like a Jesuit would, right? So it's pretty interesting that they're just doing all this stuff. And once you read through some of this stuff, it becomes really obvious what's going on. The Protestants are being used as proxy warriors, and the Jesuit fear porn, as I would call it, is, you know, driving that. And then the last few bits here, they make special plans to keep the Jesuits out of the universities. Again, some of them might be expelled. They're ex-Jesuits technically, but whatever. They just want these types of people out. And they made a special commission by the adept named Hermes Trismegistus. This guy is supposed to watch guard against the Jesuits at the university. And he says that the people at Munich in the university system, they're trying to expel all the Jesuits there that are in the academia. Because remember, if Frederick the Great is accepting them there, they're all going to be hanging out during these areas in these areas. And then they're glad that they have dismissed them all from Ingolstadt, which is where Weishaupt was. So there's like a secret battle against the Jesuits going on amongst these Bavarian Illuminati. And here's another interesting bit. The more religious degrees were more popular in the Catholic countries, but the ones that were more standardly religious, the Protestants didn't take them as well, but the ones that were more radical, the Protestants took to them much more easily, but the Catholics shunned them. So it's kind of funny just showing there's a Catholic bulwark against this stuff. And the last thing I'd mention here is the first chapter, Adam Weishaupt, it starts out with him trying to get an abortion. He had an adulterous relationship of sorts. His wife died, and then he basically has an affair. Well, he's not married to his sister-in-law. His wife is dead, but he's having relations with her, and they have a child. So he's trying to hide this. There's letters where he's trying to get an abortion, a doctor to perform the abortion, and they're willing to go through with it, but they can't get anybody. And so he's distressed because he doesn't, this is interesting. He's not distressed because of his reputation among Catholics. He's distressed because he talks about virtue among his Illuminati brethren, and he doesn't want to let them know that he screwed up and couldn't control his passions. So he's more caring about his reputation in his own order than he is about the Catholic man cracking down on him. And so then later on, when the Bavarian Illuminati the Bavarian police raid the Illuminati, they find like poisons or recipes for abortion, stuff like that. It seems to be related to this. But then Weishaupt denies it and says, I had no reason to ever use any of this stuff. I don't even know what it is. He denies it completely. But in the letter you find later, he's obviously looking for it. So what's really interesting here is this is the first chapter. And so if Thomas Jefferson got this book from Barwell to warn in America about this, it's interesting. There's a letter from Thomas Jefferson to Bishop Madison in 1800 at the foundersarchives.org. This is like United States history. And he's commenting on Barwell's third book of the Illuminati. And he calls Barwell a raving mad person. He calls Adam Weishaupt an enthusiastic philanthropist. He says he read about an hour into it. And you would think if you read an hour into it, you'd read the first chapter and see that Weishaupt's trying to get an abortion. And so apparently you would think that maybe that might be a concern if some guy's trying to get an abortion and let's ignore that. He's an enthusiastic philanthropist. So that shows you maybe perhaps something about Thomas Jefferson. Maybe he didn't read that chapter, but to me, it'd be logical. You read about an hour in, why would you not read the first chapter? So my point is, when a lot of Catholics might be a little overly enamored with Jefferson, think about something like that. And then Jefferson also says at the French Revolution, this letter, people are denouncing it as horrible and awful. He says, maybe it will stand in a better light than at present in like the history books. And I'd say that it, you know, basically did. So, you know, there's some more stuff here. I'll just read the last couple bits real quick and I'll be done. They are chapter three. They're looking to target Lutherans and Calvinists over Roman Catholics to try to bring them into esoteric Illuminism. They also invent a fake women's rights of sorts where they use women who are quote unquote more loose with their morals to satisfy the passions of the lower adepts, and that the more virtuous women, they'll be allowed kind of like a female Illuminati degree, but they're still to be under the direction of men, but they think that they're not, right? So women, you are free and you are in the upper echelons of society. You're leading the charge, but secretly the adepts are saying, well, they're still under the direction of men. And it's in chapter three on pages 417. You can read about that. And there's this Noahide aspect of Masonry where there's this universal religion before the Abrahamic covenant. And so that gets back to like these laws, universal laws beforehand. So sometimes when Jews promote that, that might actually be more of a Kabbalist enlightenment viewpoint rather than a Jewish one. Because then it's kind of denying the covenants, right? And then chapter 12, this is where you get like perfection of man stuff. It could easily lead to transhumanism. This shows the influence of a lot of Rousseau stuff that Weishaupt is perfecting. And then the last two chapters I'll mention, chapter 16, this is important with dealing with the clergy and writing the Jesuitical degrees to give to princes to make it seem religious. And they want to give their illuminees as much zeal as the Catholics give their own, but while they reduce the Catholics' zeal. So it's funny when everyone calls the Catholics fanatics and, oh, we just don't like fanaticism in general. But meanwhile, they're teaching their own to be just as fanatical as they project the Catholics to be, but for the Masonic principles. So that's typical of the left, right? They'll say, you know, whatever, the people who are against abortion, they're fanatics. But then all the people who are radically for abortion, they're worse, right? And their zeal for getting abortions. But then they just like act like they're just philanthropists, right? So you can see that all formulating here. And the last thing I mentioned, chapter 18, this is the grand irony. Vysop wants to get 12 Illuminees to be like the apostles and one chief, perhaps a pope, him, to lead them. So it's really funny how everyone decries the pope, this despotic ruler, have one guy in charge of all these people. That's so horrible. But Vysop is just inventing himself as his own pope, and maybe that can relate to a certain protesting spirit in the Germanic areas with people like Martin Luther. So that basically wraps it all up. I know it was a lot. I tried my best to condense it and not go into tangents.
Oh, that's great. I think that the takeaways here that I learned is this century, which is falsely called the Enlightenment, but it should be called the Age of False Reason. That's the phrase of Henry Sear in Phoenix from the Ashes.
I call it the Age of Treason.
Age of Treason is all of these occult sects or occult enthusiasts or occults, these people spreading the occult ideas. So you have Voltaire, Rousseau, who are sort of more in public, who are connected through their ideology with the occult rites. And you have these various occult rites, which are Masonic or not, but they're all sort of generating the same message, which is all against Christendom, against Christ in society, against the Catholic Church.
Exactly. That's Barwell's point. It's a holistic thing. And usually that's what the detractors do. They're like the Pharisees, right? They make specks into logs and they ignore the logs in their own eyes, or they make, you know, camels out of gnats or things like that, right? And they don't. And honestly, that's similar to like the issues of Protestantism, right? Where it's like, oh, Catholics, you're relying on your works. And, you know, it's like, and ironically, a lot of their own beliefs, the Catholics also believe, but there's distinctions and orderings of things. And it's a holistic thing with certain things having more priority than others, right? And so when they attack something and act like the Catholics don't do something, they're actually doing that. It's just they're making more sweeping statements. So I think that that's what happens in the reverse, where the so-called Age of Reason will defend its own so-called enlightenment by the same methods, where they'll attack Barwell for these small issues that he's not even making into a big issue. And this is the Voltaire account that we talked about earlier, where the deathbed so-called conversion of Voltaire, whether it happened or not. It's funny that when I was reading the liberals' history says, well, Barwell made a big deal about that. And it's Barwell's fault that there's even a debate about Voltaire. Did he convert to Catholicism at the end of his life or not? And the funny thing is, when I read it, it just looks like Barwell is just documenting the history of it. And it's one chapter. He doesn't make that much of a big deal out of it. Everything else is more of a big deal. But maybe it's more of a big deal to the liberals. And they're the ones who make a big deal out of it. And they project everybody else onto that, making the bigger deal. And where they're just trying to like add it into, you know, just the general history. And, you know, making mountains out of molehills is a way to attack things. So I think that that's kind of the overlap here. The basic tactics for attacking Catholicism in the schema and how they do it, it's no different, but they're attacking it for different reasons, where the Protestant quote unquote revolt is kind of like faith alone. And then the Enlightenment so-called revolt is like reason alone. Right. And then the Catholicism is about bringing those two things together. Right. You know, and I think it just shows that great divorce, and not ironically, the Masonic pillars being separated as kind of like their logo kind of encompasses that. And what it really does is the people in that middle pillar are just going to pragmatically appeal to whatever's convenient to just stay in power for money and without any real morality whatsoever. And they think they're beyond morality. And they don't have a problem if you try to obey it in some broad sense, as long as you aren't in politics, right? You can be a Christian in your church and you can be moral. You can be in a non-adulterous relationship, but don't bring that into the public sphere. As long as that doesn't happen, you're fine, right? And I think that that's really the problem here, is that's what's really being divorced. And then a lot of the Protestants are thinking that the church and state separated, as the Enlightenment says, is like Christian. And you can see that overlap where they're always appealing to Christianity and Christ. And they even say that we do this to kind of, you know, be pragmatic and get people to be like, oh, they're talking about Christ. I'm listening, right? And you need the distinctions and the details to go with it. And I think that that's where that spirit shows a difference, where the church focuses more on having a definition and holding on to that dogmatically, because if you start playing with it too much, then you're just going to be misled by all that stuff. So that's the bulwark. And I think you see that in spades here with the satanic establishment revealing its hand in that reverse way, where they say the Protestants are very useful for us. The Catholics and the Jesuits at that time, not so much. They're our number one enemy. So is that kind of revealing the true enemy and the true church in a way? That would be kind of a reverse argument I might make.
Yeah. So all of these forces, occult forces or public forces, and then you also have 40,000 Protestant sects today, all agreeing on one thing, and that's not Rome. And then you have various Jewish Kabbalists thrown in, and every force is just trying to undermine the Roman Catholic Church. And we didn't get into the Eastern Orthodox, which is the interesting bit as well. But next time we're going to go to 1800 to World War II, right? That's the plan.
Yes. And we can start out talking about the Jesuits in Russia and just do the carry over there, because I think it's really interesting, because there's a lot of similar things where maybe they were actually helping fighting against the liberalism, but then a lot of the Orthodox side will actually promote the Black Legend propaganda that came from the Enlightenment to attack them, and then say all the Enlightenment is evil and awful. It's like, shouldn't you be thanking those Jesuits for combating that rather than promoting what the Enlightenment said to attack Spain and the Jesuits? Seems very contradictory to me.
Yeah, it's even the Russia, even Dostoevsky's got the Grand Inquisitor chapter, which is just a rehashing of a Black Legend invented by a heretic.
And he's like one of my favorite authors.
I know.
Crime and Punishment is my favorite novel of all time.
Yeah, I love Dostoevsky. Yeah. But you know. Same old, same old. Anyways, well, we got to wrap up here. Michael, thank you once again for sharing all of your knowledge. Let's offer up a Pater Noster at the end of the show. Once again, for Christ's victory over the occult, for souls who have been deceived by occult forces, that we may unite against this conspiracy of the fallen angels and liberate these poor souls who are merely puppets of the fallen angels by the resurrection of Christ. In nomine Patris et Filii Spiritus Sancti. Amen. Pater noster, qui es in caelis, sanctificetur nomen tuum, adveniat regnum tuum, fiat voluntas tua, sicut in cielo et in terra.
Panem nostrum quotidianum de nobis hodie, et dimitte nobis debita nostra, sicut et nos dimittimus debitoribus nostris, et ne nos inducas in tentationem, sed libera nos a malo. Amen.
In nomine Patris, et Filii, Spiritus Sancti. Amen. Christ is risen.
In